Okay, good evening, everyone. Oh. I want to fix the mic. It's a little... It's too loud.
It has an echo.
Because it's too loud. Okay, is it better? You can hear me nice? Okay. So, today I want to welcome all of you for our last and final lesson. When we first started with JLI courses, you know, close to 18 years ago, the courses used to be 8 weeks. Then they went down to 6 weeks. Now they're 4 weeks courses. Soon there'll be 2 weeks, and soon there'll be 1 week, you know, we'll keep condensing it. Anyway, I think that this final one is focusing really on, I would call it the last 2 points of how dealing with anti-Semitism, more, how would I put it, like innocent anti-Semitism. What do you mean by innocent anti-Semitism? I'll give you an example. The Senate, one of the senators votes against allowing Israel to get defense missiles. I'm going to give an example, whatever it is. So, in our mind, it's an anti-Semite, yeah? But they don't feel that they're voting because they're anti-Israel. They have a different reason, you know, budget, or, you know, they blame other concepts that make it sound that I'm not a bad guy for Israel. You know what I'm saying? So how do we deal with those kind of things, really? More, you understand, like political people, political positions, governments that are doing kinds of things that are really not pro-Judaism, pro-Israel. As we said in the lesson one, that Israel today is the new anti-Semitism. But how do we deal with that? How do we go about that? I could give you 100 examples of just the last few months, but I don't want to get into it because then everyone thinks I'm taking this side or another side. So I'm going to speak about something that happened with Israel before the Six-Day War. Israel, their main supplier for weapons was not America. In the 1960s, 50s. Who was it?
France.
France. Can you imagine France today? You look at France, you think France is the enemy of Israel. Well, then France supplied Israel. Anyways, what happened was, before the Six-Day War, Norman. Yemin Hashem. Before the Six-Day War, it was like, France didn't know what to do exactly because the Arab countries are pushing them not to supply. Israel already paid for 50 new planes. This is before the Six-Day War. So they decided, the president of France then says, okay, we're making an embargo that we're not selling weapons to anyone, not to Egypt, not to Israel. But really we know that who suffered was Israel, because Egypt was getting from Russia. So really, even though I said the embargo is for everyone, whoever's fighting, but really, who is the beaten bush is the Jew, because the Jew is the only supplier was France. The enemy was getting from Russia, from who knows where. You know what I'm saying? So then what happened was, in 1970, again, there's an embargo. We're not giving weapons not to Israel and not to the Arabs. All of a sudden, the president of France makes an announcement. We're selling 50 planes to Libya. Now, Libya then was such an enemy of Israel. I mean, the whole Entebbe, wasn't that in the... Right? The plane landed in Libya. So Now, those 50 planes that officially they're selling to Libya were the 50 planes that Israel already paid for and France never delivered to them because of the embargo. So how would you react to this French president? Officially, your embargo, so no one gets, and now you're selling to Libya. What's going on? If it's an embargo, it's an embargo. What are you? Why Libya, the fierce enemy of Israel in that time and even today a little? Why would you do that? So how would we respond to that? So that's why I took a story of that happened, because today I could take another 100 stories. You know, with I forget which senator today is blocking the, you know, Israel needs these anti-missile protection. What do they call anti-missile?
Iron Dome.
So they want America to supply the
missile,
the things that they need, and this guy is blocking it. I forgot the senator's name here in U.S.
Rand Paul.
Whatever it is. So you think to yourself, it doesn't make a difference, but you think to yourself, is he anti-Semitic? How do we react to this? So let's just read, if you could go to text 1 on page 116. Text 1, page 116. You have it, or? Just, this is this where they got into this thing.
French officials acknowledged tonight that about 50 Mirage jet fighter planes would be sold to Libya. The confirmation of the sale was expected to provoke sharp protests from Israel. The Israelis suspect that the planes will sooner or later find their way to the fighting front. The French Defense Ministry reaffirmed the French embargo policy of selling no arms to the countries directly in conflict. Israel, the United Arab Republic, Jordan, and Syria, and said that they were convinced that Libya could supply her own forces. Israeli fear of the Libyan mirages is based on a conviction shared by some French experts that the Libyan Air Force, in its present state, could not absorb such numbers of a highly advanced plane. The fear is compounded by the aggressive stance taken toward Israel by the new revolutionary military regime, which has been in power in Libya since early September. The plane sold to Libya is believed to be the Mirage 3, the same type as the 50 built for Israel, but placed under embargo in 1967. The Israelis are expected to find particularly galling the fact that they have been denied about the same number of planes now made available to a hostile Arab country.
Guess what happened? In 1970, the president of France comes to the United States and he's giving a speech, you know, by the, what should the Jews do? How should they react when this president comes to the United States? Should they protest? Should they, you know, put ads in the papers, anti-Semite? What should be our approach?
Everything.
Huh?
Everything.
Everything? What do you mean?
Put ads,
like anti, you're anti-Israel, anti-Semite.
Take him out to dinner.
Take him out to dinner.
Clear.
Okay. So, my dear friends, I, in a kosher French restaurant with French wine. Yeah. My dear friends, we're lucky that we're finishing the course this week, because this week, in the portion of the Torah that we read every week, we read another portion in the Torah, gives us the answer of how do we react to anti-Semite political leaders or influential leaders, whether it's ministers, whether it's kings, whether it's prime ministers, whether it's government, those people that have influence. An interesting thing that, I don't know if you read in the paper today, I don't read the paper, but something strange happened on, what's today? Today's Tuesday, right? So yesterday, Monday, I went to the Israeli embassy for a few minutes. And as I was there, they said to me, look here, the Minister of Interior Ministers here. The Israeli Interior, who is that? Ayelet Shaked. She's a minister in the government, and she was there. You know. Anyway, so I asked, why is she here? Like, why did she come from Israel to America? She says, because she's going to Washington. I think she was there today. And she's meeting to try to eliminate the visa requirement for Israeli citizens that want to come to visit America. They need a visa. You know, so you can't just come to visit America. So they
come through the border on down south.
South, you could do anything. You could just walk across, you know. Anyway, to make a long story short, so she, what's her meeting? She spoke today. She gave a whole speech about it, trying to convince the U.S. to allow Israelis to just come. Just like if you want to go now to England, you don't need a visa. You know what I'm saying? Okay. Now, the obstacles, there's a lot of obstacles. I don't even know the whole story. But one of the things that's funny is that the U.S. Department that makes, you know, these decisions say to her, okay, if you want us to do that, well, you have to allow Palestinians to have an embassy in Jerusalem, and you have to allow, stop construction in Samaria and Judah for the, you know, because they're building a lot of new Jewish homes. Now, what does one got to do with another? I don't know, because I don't know the whole politics. But I'm just giving you an example that here you have a U.S. department that's the most closest ally now to Israel, right? I mean, from all the whole world, who is very strong with Israel is the U.S. Am I right? Okay, yeah, I know. I'm saying what used to be
a year
ago. But anyways, the point there is, when it comes to some things, it's like strange that they would treat you like you're not even part of, you're not even, like we're not allies. You know what I'm saying? Something went, like what happened here? Just an example, I just heard it today. A funny thing is that someone told me today, an Israeli says, when you go to the American embassy in Tel Aviv, was it, is there in Tel Aviv an American embassy even today? So there's one in Jerusalem and one in Tel Aviv.
It's a consulate, yeah, they changed it. But when you want to get papers,
you go to Tel Aviv? And there is also
in Tel Aviv.
And what's in Jerusalem?
The embassy.
So you don't go to the embassy, really.
So
he told me an interesting thing. He says when Israelis go to the American embassy, it's a very cold treatment. Like you don't, you come in, boom, bam, beam. No. There's no, I don't know, I can't, it was like.
When you come from an Israeli territory concept to an American, it seems cold.
Right, exactly. So
it
was just a funny thing. Anyway, so how do we treat it? So, we'll tell you the story that happens in this week's parsha, and this is how we treat it, and it's been successful for 3,000 years, but it doesn't mean that they're not anti-Semites. You know, so we're not going to change, just to remember one thing, we're not going to able to change an anti-Semite to not become an anti-Semite. So that's not going to happen just like this. At the same point, I just want you to remember, which is very important, that the people that are allies and friends of Israel doesn't mean that it stays forever. So it could take a minute and they could turn around. I mean, everything could go both ways. You see it in history constantly. What happened here? Yaakov, which is our third father, from the three fathers, had a twin brother, Esav. And he came back from his 20-year journey, and he wants to meet his brother, Esav. So he sent messengers to find out what's the status of his brother, because he ran away from his brother wanted to kill him. Now it's 34 years later, and he wants to know what's going on. So the messengers come back, and they say, very simple. We met your brother. He's coming towards you. He wants to kill you, and he has 400 men, and he wants to kill you and your whole family. So what does he do now, Yaakov? He has a whole family, four wives, 12 children. all this flock. I mean, it's a ganze meisa here with servants, and he has his brother coming to kill him with 400 people. So what did he do? So he didn't take signs and hang up, okay, anti-Semite, you know, and go over the whole government. He decided and taught us what to do. We do three things. First thing is pray. Pray, God, you could make everything happen. Make a miracle. You know, you could have America do the right thing. You could have Russia do the right thing. You could have Iraq do the right thing. I mean, you could do anything. God is not, no limit. Number two, and this is a very important thing, tremendous gifts. Tremendous. I mean, the amount of gifts he gave his brother Esav was, today in value of money, it's billions. I mean, tremendous amount of gifts. I remember when I went to Russia in 1991, the end of 1991. So, in those times, Russia wasn't like today. So we had to get places, and you couldn't get anything. Like, you go to the store, there's nothing in the store. Where do you get tomatoes? Nothing. Everything is under the table. So we had to get, I remember, train tickets back from Kharkov to Moscow, which is an overnight train, to get back to America. But you can't get tickets. A week before, you can't get tickets. 4 days before, you can't. It's like you're talking through the wall. There's no tickets, you know. So how do you get back? So it was Saturday night. It was after Shabbos. So we got a bus took us with all our luggage, and we said, you know, we're just going on to the train. We don't have tickets. We'll just get on the train, and when the conductor comes, we'll tell him, listen, we tried to get tickets, but we couldn't. But we will stand in the hallway. But we have to get to America. We have to catch a flight the next day. Anyways, the conductor comes, and we had a few packs of Marlboro cigarettes. In Russia, in those times, Marlboro cigarettes was like gold in those times. And we gave it to the conductor with some chocolates and a few other things that they don't have in Russia. All of a sudden, he comes back, and there's two beautiful cabins, empty, beautiful, just for us. We were able to have our own minion, and it was like, I couldn't believe it. There was no tickets, and all of a sudden there's two cabins. So, oh, what miracle happened? Now, this guy, this conductor that gave it to us, you think he loves me? He loves Jews? He doesn't love Jews. But you give him a few nice gifts, at least you get him on your, you get what I'm saying? And, okay. The third thing Yaakov prepared was for war, meaning, he was ready that if he has to fight, we're going to fight. This is something that we have to learn in everything today. And we'll go through it in a minute. Let's just read text 2 for a moment. Where's the thing? Yeah. It's page 119. Say.
Jacob prepared himself for a three-pronged assignment. A prayer, a gift, struggle.
You know what happened? After giving all the gifts, and not only that, whenever he spoke to his brother, he said, my Lord. And when he spoke about himself, he said, your servant. So he said, I'm your servant, and the anti-Semite is my Lord. You know what I mean? Like, number three is after he gave him all the gifts, he actually fell on the floor, you know, like prostrated himself flat, like showing respect to his brother 7 times. And they're 97 years old. It's not like he's a young man. And now what happens? Look in text 3. So three things he did, four things. He ran, he hugged him. He fell on his neck, he kissed him, and he cried. So this big anti-Semite, Esav, that was a few minutes ago going to kill his brother with his whole family, what is he doing now? Just opposite. He's crying, he's weeping, he's hugging, and he's embracing him. What happened? Now look in the Hebrew for a second on the screen. Is it easy for you to see or no? Could you see it, or it's hard for you to see? There's one word there that has like a red circle around it. You see like a... Let me see if he... Yeah. Vayishakehu, which is the Hebrew word, he kissed him. In Hebrew, when you say someone kissed, Vayishakehu. But if you look closely, on top of every letter of the word, there's a dot. You see like a circle dot? In the scroll, in the Torah, there's that dot. Now, the Torah has no vowels, no notes, no punctuations, nothing. Only those six letters have a dot on top of each letter. What are those dots? Why, on top of kissing, is there six dots? Yeah? So there's two opinions. One opinion says that he didn't really, when he kissed him, he didn't really mean it. He actually wanted to bite him. But, you know, another opinion, which is Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, he says, no. This moment was a real kiss, a real hug, a real embrace, a real cry. Not because Esav is not any more anti-Semite, no. But Yaakov, through his hard work of gifts and all the things he did till he got to Esav, he was able to change that momentarily. It was a real hug. Momentarily, it was a real kiss. And momentarily, it was a real cry. But Esav still is an Esav. He's still the anti-Semite. But what Yaakov did was able to get him that momentarily he sincerely meant it. So it's almost like two opposites. On one hand, Esav is ready to kill him. And he had 400 people with a whole army to kill his whole family. And he could have done it in a minute. 400 men against what? 11 little children with four wives? I mean, how hard is that? With a few servants there, 100 servants. But what Yaakov did accomplished that moment Esav really hugged him with real love. It's not that he changed his being, but he changed that for this moment his attitude was truly a hug and a kiss and an embrace. This is what happened. Look in text 4. Yeah.
The Torah features God over the words and kissed him. This is because Esau did not kiss Jacob wholeheartedly. Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai said, "It is an established fact that Esau hates Jacob. Nevertheless, his compassion was moved at that time and he kissed him wholeheartedly."
So what does he say? Two opposites. Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, by the way, lived during the Romans. He was the one that wrote the Zohar. He was hidden. He had to hide in the cave for 13 years, him and his son, because the Roman Caesar wanted to kill him. So he knows what it means, running away from an anti-Semite. You know, he knew the whole thing. 13 years hiding in a cave and ate only carob and water for 13 years. I mean, that's a real runaway. Yet, he says, that even though Esav, which means the anti-Semite hates you, that's the fact, but yet this moment he really loved him. It wasn't a fake love. It was a real love. It was a real hug. It was a real kiss and a real embrace. Because of the gifts and the prayer and whatever he did. Why does the Torah tell us this? Like, why do we read this in the Torah? It's teaching us, for our future generations, how we deal with anti-Semites. Pray. Give a lot of gifts. But be ready for war. Strength and a lot of gifts. You know he's anti-Semite. You know he doesn't like you, or she, or whatever it is. But, yeah, what did you want to ask, Ari?
Are there other times in the Torah that there are
There are a few times, yeah. You remember the other time? Yeah. By Sarah, Ayay. Ayay, Sarah Yishlecha. There's a few more times in that. Whenever there's dots on a word, a letter in the Torah, means it's as if the letter is not there. So what does Vayishakeu mean? He kissed him. But this, since there's a dot on each letter, means it's as if the word is not there. So that means he didn't kiss him.
I am only Nun in Shakeu.
Huh?
Nun.
Upside down Nun, you mean?
Nun, letter shake.
No, Vayishakehu. Vayashkehu. This is Vayishakehu. Okay. No. But that's one of the things with the dots. The question is, if there's more dots in a word than the word, let's say there's six letters, and four letters have dots, so then do you say it's missing four letters and the three letters are the main thing, or do you say the four letters are the main thing? Whatever, the Gemara goes into it. But the dots tells you that the word, the way it is not the way it is. Don't translate it regular. It's not a regular translation. Huh?
It's like this in English?
Yeah, something like that. What is it? How was that? Just...
It's a PowerPoint.
Yeah, like, yeah. Exactly, a lot of people do, yeah. That's exactly the concept. So he kissed him, but it's not, you know, it's a temporary kiss. Okay. Now, in the times of the Romans, which the Romans are, by the way, the grandchildren of Esav. So Romans, we always use Romans as the symbol of Esav, which is Yaakov's brother, because he's the father of the Romans. But we also use them as the symbol of the nation that was anti-Jews, because the Romans were fiercely anti-Jews. Now, just for you to know, Romans was the first government that actually adopted the Christian religion as their government. You understand what I'm saying? That it became part of their government. There were other people that were Christians, but that the government should become a Christian government and accept Christianity as their, you know, way of life or whatever, was the Romans. And very fierceful and very strong and very, you know, a lot of blood was killed because of it. So the Jews lived under this Roman power for many years. The Rome was there for a long time. So how did they deal with it? So look what he says in text 5.
The Midrash relates that when Rabbi Yonai would set out for a meeting with the Roman government, he would first read this passage in the Torah regarding Jacob and Esau. The sages had a tradition that this passage was a guide for our exile. Therefore, when Rabbi Yonai would visit the rulers of Rome for communal issues, he would consult this passage to follow the advice of the wise Jacob. It is indeed appropriate for all generations to study the approach and to adopt it in actual practice.
You understand? So every time he had to go to the Romans to try to change a decree, he used to read the story of this week's Parsha with Yaakov and Esav and see the way Jacob treated Esav and use these techniques to go to Rome and try to overcome the decree. Now, Rav Shimon bar Yochai, that had to hide from the Romans for 13 years, in text 6, look what he says. Look what happened with the Romans. One time,
The Roman government once issued a decree that Jews may not observe Shabbat, circumcision, and family purity. The Jews said to themselves, "Who should go to Rome to solicit annulment of the decree? Let Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai go, for he is experienced in miracles."
So Shimon ben Yochai, that had to run away for 13 years from this Roman government that wants to kill him, he went to them to nullify these decrees. I mean, so he knows who he's dealing with. But he did it in a very smart way. He was able to nullify it. But again, it was not by arguing and fighting and shooting. It was by gifts and all kinds of things. Yeah.
Did he go to Rome after he had a run to the cave for 12 or 15?
Yeah, yeah.
He came out, and then I guess the Caesar was gone, dead, and he.
There's a new Caesar. Rome is on.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay, so Rome is how many years ago? This whole thing, let's say 1800 years ago. But throughout history, Jews always took this method, this path. Gifts, respect, knowing that they're anti-Semitic, knowing that they're our enemies, but yet took this approach. And if you look on your page 123, he goes through different parts of history. You see it or no? Joseph of Rosheim, Jacob Basivi, Shmuel Oppenheimer, Samson Wertheimer, Joseph Sue Oppenheimer. Okay, anyways, they always had this approach. So we're just going to pick one that happened between 1480 and 1554. Joseph Rosen, Rosheim, he was an advocate on the German Jews by the Roman Empire. Let me tell you where this is. 1480 is, the Spanish Inquisition was 1492, right?
12 years before.
Yeah, so what happened was, a lot of Jews went to Germany, Poland, Russia, you know, and started to settle there. So this guy went to the Romans, to the Caesar, to try to influence that the Jews should be protected in Germany, not to do an expulsion of the Jews in Germany or from Poland or wherever they were. Let Jews be there. So even though they expelled them from Spain, how many years before? 12 years later, he went and he advocated at least for the Jews in Germany and the Jews in France to be safe, leave them. Don't, you know? And he jeopardized he put himself in danger, but he did it in a respectful way. So in text 7, he tells you what he did. Huh? But in a, gave them gifts, bought them big diamonds, big rings, and all kinds of things. Yeah.
In 1531, the denouncers once again hounded the Emperor Charles V while he was enveloping Holland, lands uninhabited by Jews. Many requested that I travel to those lands to oppose the accusers with the help of God. I was at the court of the exalted Emperor for 4 months, from the first of Adar until the first of Sivan, pursuing the interests of the Jewish communities. Although Rothbroit attempted to swallow me alive and bring about my demise, God, in his great mercy, sent his messenger and saved me from his hands and from all those who sought to harm me. At that time, I had an audience with the emperor in his private chamber. I spoke to him for as long as I needed, and he responded sympathetically. During this period, when I had free time and was secluded in my room, I authored a book entitled The Sanctified Path.
Okay, just giving an example. Now, how does it work in your brain that you hate, this guy is such an anti-Semite, he hates you, and then he's giving you a hug and a kiss after you gave him the gifts, and then, like, what happens? Like, what happens in the brain? What changes there? Like, what happened to the guy? This big anti-Semite, also, boom, what happened? So there's a scientific, saying that there's, in your brain, there's this, like, part of your brain that thinks one way, but then in the practicality acts a different way because of different parts that influence it and do it a total different way. It doesn't mean that subconsciously everything changed, but all of a sudden they're thinking differently. So just quickly read text 8a and 8b, yeah? Page 128, you have it?
Cognitive difference. Yeah. Brains are like representative democracies. They are built of multiple overlapping experts who weigh in and compete over different choices. There is an ongoing conversation among the different factions in your brain, each competing to control the single output channel of your behavior. When the hostess at a party offers chocolate cake, you find yourself on the horns of a dilemma. Some parts of your brain have evolved to crave the rich energy source of the sugar, and other parts care about the negative consequences, such as the health of your heart. Part of you wants the cake, and part of you tries to muster the fortitude to forego it. The final vote of the parliament determines which party controls your action, that is, whether you put your hand up or out. As the French essayist Michel de Montaigne put it, there is as much difference between us and ourselves as there is between us and others.
Okay, you got the point. Now let's go back to our question that we started in the beginning of the class with the French president that came to the United States after he made an embargo on Israel not to sell them any of the 50 planes, even though they already paid for it. How do the Jews in America treat him when he came here? So I'll tell you what they did. This is in 1970. They made strong protests against him. They hung up signs all over, anti-Semite. They put in all the papers and the radios. They booed him wherever he went, in Chicago, in New York City. And to the point that President Nixon, you remember Nixon? Well, he's still alive now.
No.
So President Nixon came specially from the White House to New York to apologize to President of France on the disrespect Americans gave him. Like, it was such a real disrespect. So, look, I skipped to text 9, page 131. President Nixon.
President Nixon made a hurried trip to New York yesterday to apologize to President Pompidou, who was angered by what he termed insult to himself and his wife during pro-Israeli demonstrations touched off by his state visit to the United States. The French president had been angered by a jostling that members of his party received from demonstrators in Chicago, whose actions were marked by booze and angry cries and by what he viewed as acceptance of such hostile acts by the Chicago police.
Okay. So the President Nixon came and said to President of France, listen, I'm so sorry that our country treated you like this. The Rebbe, Rabbi Schneerson, which was the Rebbe from 1950 through 1994, he got up publicly and he was against the demonstrations of the Jewish people. And I don't know if you remember, maybe you're too young for then, but there was many demonstrations in America about Russia. It was let my people go, which is in America they were demonstrating that the Russians should let the Jews go to Israel.
Struggle for Soviet Jewry.
Right? It was a major, and they made a lot of protests, and it was a big, big thing. The Rebbe was very against it. Why? Because the Rebbe knew all the Jews in Russia, the inside information. And every time there were protests in America against the Russians, it angered them, and they made it harder for the Jews in Russia. So yes, you're living in a free country, you know, that you could scream as much as you want, I hate this, I hate that, freedom of speech. But in Russia, what the outcome was that the Jews in Russia were suffering. So like a lot of Jews that applied for visas to leave Russia were all denied. Jews that were supposed to be freed from prison were all, you know. So the Rebbe knew what was going inside. So he says, the best way to do these things, to accomplish all these things, is not through you're bad. There's quiet, diplomatic, under the table stuff. That's the way things are going to get done. And that's how a lot of things got done in Russia. You know, to get things moving, you couldn't yell and scream. You knew they hate you. But you had to do Yaakov's approach. Give gifts and gifts and gifts and buy them till you get your way.
Yeah. But people that were demonstrating here are so far removed, but they want to do something. Right, they can't be diplomatic. They don't have any. Like, I think people feel like that's the only thing that they can do. So I understand why it's counterproductive, maybe. But what can those people do?
You mean what could they do to help the Jews in Russia or whatever? What do you say, Norman? What could they do?
They did both, and both it worked, because you had the protests. And then you had the underlying negotiation, which brought it out. Remember, Nixon turned out to be the best friend for Israel, wound up sending him twice as much as
France.
Not only more than France, but wound up sending them more than our Jewish Secretary of State, Kissinger.
Oh, Kissinger, yeah.
So
that was it was the Yom Kippur War, no?
Yeah.
Right, Yom Kippur War.
But it was Nixon, the guy who went to Washington, or to New York to appease the
French guy.
So
I'll tell you two things.
God works in
to answer her question. One is, honestly, what we could do here in America is pray. But second, honestly, is they had a lot. They still have it today, but a lot of organizations that you could help with funds that they actually gave it to the Jews in Russia for food, for mezuzahs, for tefillin, for kosher, whatever. No, the limit was infinite. You know, matzah, Passover, whatever. Hundreds of, you know, that really, really helped in there. And the hardest thing is when you have to bribe the
conductor
with a pack of cigarettes, it costs a lot of money. It's a lot of things. So the quiet diplomatic is expensive. Mm-hmm. Like Yaakov spent $1 billion, but it was worth it. He saved his family. This is I'm just giving an example. It's an expensive way of doing it. It's like you have to go to the today in America. I'll give you an example. When we came to Tenafly 28 years ago, they told us Tenafly is not for Jews. It's the wrong town. This is not for Jews. 28 years ago. Now, I think Tenafly is the only Jewish town there is. There's no other. Anyways, but except Englewood Cliffs. But they told us you're not allowed to move here. It's not. So what happened was we had to get our first zoning and approvals 26 years ago for the shul in different places. And I asked the attorney, how does it work here in this community? Could you bribe people? He says, no, in Tenafly you can't bribe. So he says, what do you mean? I thought the bribery is, that's the way things work. He says, not in Tenafly. He says, what do? You don't bribe them. You bring a whole tray of jelly donuts for Hanukkah, and you leave it in the by the municipality. You say it's for everyone. So you're not giving it to an individual, so you're not bribing anyone. And this is for the holiday. Jelly donuts from Chabad. It comes Purim. You give baskets of food from Chabad to everyone in the municipality. Hamantashen, matzah, whatever, blintzes, whatever it is. What happens is, it's not that they become, all of a sudden, they remember the jelly donut. You know what I mean? That good jelly that went into their mouth. You know, they remember the Hamantashen. So then when you have to go for zoning, yes, you didn't bribe them, you didn't give any money in their pocket, but you smeared it. You You oil the wheels that it goes easier. You're getting that concept. So, and that's one of the issues that you have in a lot of governments, especially in Israel. Like, they get a, like when the prime minister leaves, all of a sudden they put him in jail. Why they put him in jail? Because they claim he got this bribery or that bribery, or they, his wife got this jewelry or that jewelry. But that's how everything works in any government. If you want to move things, you gotta buy dishes and cars for everyone. You know what I mean? So, in 10b, just read 10a for a second.
The public protest against the president of France angered French officials. This blocked any lobbying efforts that French Jews might have been able to make to prevent, or at least reduce, French assistance to Arab countries that are hostile to Israel. The stated reason for these protests was to demonstrate that America is a democratic country and that American Jews are not cowardly. This is a worthwhile objective when Jewish lives are not at risk. However, when Jews are threatened with the sale of many military jets to Libya, we have two options. We can organize public protests, or we can make every effort to either prevent or postpone the sale, reduce the number of jets sold, or to at least prevail upon the French to send less effective planes. Such aims can only be achieved through quiet diplomacy. The proof is that agreements of this nature have been reached in the past.
Clear? Okay, read the next one, 10b.
When Mr. Pompidou visited the United States, there were mass protests against him intended to intimidate France. This effort backfired. It can now be said that despite the French embargo against selling arms to belligerents in the Middle East, the French president had allowed the sale of small arms and light weapons to Israel, items that can be sold without attracting publicity. However, as a result of the demonstrations, the approval for such sales was withdrawn. After some time, when he was no longer being disparaged, he resumed dealing with Jews behind closed doors and reinstituted the small arms sales. He also arranged for 300 Jews to be able to leave Egypt. All of this was accomplished without demonstrations and without publicity. The Jewish media was warned against disclosing any of this, and we only know of this from non-Jewish press. The conclusion we must draw from this case is that we do not influence anti-Semites by constantly yelling at them, "You are an anti-Semite, you are a thief, you are a murderer." Rather, engage them in diplomatic conversation. Although such individuals are well aware of what we think about them, they are nevertheless human beings and wish to behave like human beings.
Okay, doesn't mean they love us. Don't get me wrong, they hate us, but we could get them the temporary love. Just to end off, yeah, huh?
You sell their art.
Yeah. just to end off with two pieces. Alan Dershowitz is a very pro Jew advocate. He once wrote a letter to the Rebbe, Rabbi Schneerson. Very disappointed with the Rebbe. What happened? There was a senator that was elected to be senator of North Carolina in 1972. His name was Jesse Helms. You knew him?
Yes.
How did you know him? You don't look like from 1972. Anyway, so he... In a movie. So he was, for a decade, he voted everything against Israel. Like when they ate for Israel, against. When Israel invaded Lebanon, he made a suggestion in the Senate to pull away all, disconnect from Israel totally. So this is from 1972 to 1980s. In the 80s, he was always everything against Israel. In 1984, the Chabad movement with the President Reagan made in Washington a day of education day that the President signed in that on the Rebbe's 82nd birthday, the Rebbe Lubavitch Rebbe is going to be dedicated this day for Education Day, that everyone should add an education and education. And all the senators came, and this senator, the anti-Israel, anti-this, was there also. And he was part of the celebration of Education Day and proclaiming the Rebbe, the Rebbe, the Rebbe. So Alan Dershowitz was said to the Rebbe, I mean, how could this anti-Semite, anti-Israel, how did you allow him even to stand in that room? You should have kicked him out. I know he wanted to come on his own for whatever political reason it is. Kick him out, this anti-Semite. Get out of here. So the Rebbe answered Alan Dershowitz on this complaint that he had in text 11. Just read the text.
I trust you will agree that in regard to persons of influence, whether in Washington or elsewhere, the first objective should be to persuade and encourage such a person to use his influence in a positive way in behalf of any and all good causes which are important to us. We should welcome every public appearance which lends public support to the cause, especially when there is a likelihood that it may be the forerunner of similar pronouncements in the future. My experience with such people, though I have never personally met the said person, has convinced me that politicians are generally motivated more by expediency than by conviction. In other words, their public pronouncements on various issues do not stem from categorical principles or religious imperatives. Hence, most of them, if not all, are subject to change in their positions, depending on time, place, and other factors. I believe, therefore, that the proper approach to such persons by Jewish leaders should not be rigid. As a rule, it does no good to engage in a cold war which may often turn into a hot war. Nor does it serve any useful purpose to brand one as an enemy or an anti-Semite, however tempting it is to do so, even if that person vehemently denies it. It can only be counterproductive. On the contrary, ways and means should be found to persuade such a person to take a favorable stance, at least publicly. We haven't too many friends, and attaching labels, etc., will not gain us any. Instances abound where the approach advocated above produced good results. There is surely no need to point out to you that responsible Jewish leaders consistently cultivated good public relations, indeed even cordial relations, with President Carter and his predecessors going back to President Roosevelt, regardless of their sometimes openly negative feelings towards Jews and Jewish causes.
Okay, guess what happened with this Senator Helms? He was then after this, huh?
He's dead.
He's dead, yeah. Well, Roosevelt is also dead. And Carter is still alive, or he died already?
Still alive.
He's alive?
Had a brain operation.
Oh, really?
94.
Oh, wow. He's pretty young.
Well, he had half brain, lost that one.
But listen what happened. You listen?
President
after this whole story, that this Helms, became part of this Chabad education, he was appointed to be the Foreign Relations Committee of the Senate. Very high level. And he became one of the biggest supporters of Israel. Does he mean he loves us? No. But if you do the right thing, all of a sudden you get a hug, a kiss, and an embrace.
All from the jelly donut.
All from the jelly donut.
He hates Jimmy Carter more than he hates us.
Who? That's why. That's why he did it, do you think? Okay, let him hate him. It doesn't make any difference. Just as we conclude, I just want to conclude with the last point, and before we show the video and give the diplomas. And this is very, very important. After going through these four lessons and telling us all the things about how to deal with anti-Semitism, one thing that's very, very important is that Jews amongst ourselves have to be united. Because if we're not going to be united, then the anti-Semites are going to be able to penetrate through. If we are between ourselves are one, and we're one people, then they can penetrate through. And that's 12a and 12b, page 140.
Haman told King Ahasuerus, there is one nation that is scattered and dispersed among the nations throughout all the countries of your empire.
Keep going.
Haman claimed, there is one nation that is scattered and dispersed. He was referring to the fact that Jews were internally divided. He argued that they would be unable to defend themselves because a discordant people cannot develop a cohesive strategy, nor would they pay heed to their leaders. Subsequently, when the Jews repented, there was unity among them, and they gathered in their cities with mutual love. We therefore send packages of food to one another on Purim to demonstrate that this mutual love is a clause of our deliverance.
Okay. So, one of the key elements, besides giving all the gifts and everything, is we should love each other. Jews should get along, treat each other like brothers, love each other, and that will be a nice, strong strength. We call it, that's the war within ourselves.
I had a lingering question, which is related to this passage, which is something you read last week, which are the self-hating Jews. And the ones that are, you know, actively going against Israel and really not helping the cause. How do you
fight them? How do you get them to see the light?
Right.
We spoke about it a little last week. No, we didn't mention it at all, or
you
no?
You mentioned it, but I don't know
how to do it. Kafir, how do you deal with people that are Jewish but anti-Jews?
You blame their parents.
But their parents are not to blame either. They don't either know. Honestly, I think it sounds very strange, but I see what it worked is the same way that we treat an anti-Semite. I hate to say it on a Jew, because a Jew is your brother. We'll have to treat them, you know, gifts, presents, love, jelly donuts, gefilte fish, you know, whatever. In other words, you could go to a Jew that's anti-Semite, meaning that's fighting Jew, and say, how dare you? You're crazy. How could you say you're Jewish? You know, you understand. I didn't even want to say names, but you know, you understand what I'm saying. But that's not going to work. It's the same approach, but here you're dealing with a Jew, so you know really he is your brother. So it's going to be the same thing: gifts, bribery in a good way, love, giving, sharing, and that's it. Don't get into the debate, and eventually they're going to just you know what I mean? That's the only way to really. You can't fight someone like that, just like you can't fight the anti-Semite, because they'll be the opposite. Don't argue. Just give them the gifts. Give them the love. Give them the hug and just say, come. Enjoy my Hanukkah jelly donuts, my latkes. Oh, I had the best latkes, you know. Well, then, after you give him the best latkes, maybe he'll do you a nut, you know, he'll say, you know what, Jews are not so bad. The latkes were good, you know. But that's really the approach. There's no other way. Okay, we'll end off with this video and then we'll give the diplomas.
Negative thoughts, actions, and speech create negative energy. Conversely,